This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
We are just beginning as a society to recognize the rights of gay and lesbian people. As little as 30 years ago, the world was a very different place if your sexuality didn't match the norm. If you're a gay or lesbian senior, this means you've lived the majority of your life in an atmosphere of hostility and discrimination. A new study looks at the unique needs of gay and lesbian seniors as they access the healthcare and social service system. Bill Ryan is one of the principal investigators in the study. He's with the McGill School of Social Work, and he's joined me on the phone this morning from Montreal. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So why did you decide to conduct this study?
Well, we've been working at the School of Social Work at McGill for a number of years on issues related to health, homophobia, and sexual orientation. And a lot of our studies have been related to youth, because that's the population that we are concentrating a lot of energy on exploring and trying to figure out ways of making it easier for adolescents to come to terms with being gay, lesbian, or bisexual. And we realized as we were doing our literature reviews and talking with people that there was absolutely nothing in Canada related to what we decided to call elders in our study, so those who were over 65 and dealing with health care issues. And there have been a couple of studies done in some smaller samples in Toronto, for example, and some great work done out in BC, actually in Vancouver, around issues in Vancouver, but nothing done nationally to sort of link those all up. And we decided to apply for funding to a federal social sciences research funder and put together the first national study on aging within the gay and lesbian community. And ultimately now, within the last couple of weeks, we've published the results after looking at the issue for about 5 years.
How did you go about collecting the information that went into the report?
Well, as you can probably imagine, this is not an easy population to reach. The average, say, a man or woman who's 85 today was 50 when homosexuality was decriminalized. And so the experience of living the majority of their life in an era when their sexual orientation was considered to be criminal means that most of this population, as they aged, got less and less visible, if they were visible at all previous to aging. And it isn't necessarily a group that names itself or makes itself visible at all in terms of to service providers or to family or to society at large. So we went by what we call a snowball method, which is we put ads in newspapers and community organizations. We put the word out to organizations in the cities where we conducted the research that we were interested in meeting people, and gradually people got in contact with us or were referred to us, and then we asked if we could talk to people that they knew, and they referred us on to other people, and we built our sample that way. But it took years to get even the slightly over 110 people who participated in the study to be in contact with us. We interviewed by phone or in person, depending on what people were comfortable with. We had, basic demographic questions, and then we had a qualitative interview, which means that people were not answering A, B, C, or D, but were actually talking to us for hours and hours, and then we analyzed the transcripts and coded them into an analysis.
Did you talk to you said that about 110 people participated in these interviews. Were they all elders themselves, or did you also talk to their caregivers?
We talked to caregivers, both family and informal caregivers, so friends, partners, family. And we also talked to formal healthcare providers within the public system. So it could be social workers, nurses, doctors, psychologists, people who work in nursing homes, that kind of thing. We actually had the sample split about evenly. One third of each category was interviewed.
And what do gay and lesbian seniors say are the greatest challenges that they face as they age?
Well, remarkably, and probably not surprisingly when you think about it, is they experience about the same phenomena as youth in high schools do, that they're just at the other end of the age spectrum. They fear. They're afraid of being discovered. They're afraid of discrimination. They generally don't talk about who they are or what their relationships are, which means that often their partners, sometimes lifelong conjugal partners, are not recognized by the system because they're afraid that if they're known to be in a same-sex relationship, that their partner who is in a nursing home or who's in care, who's depending upon the system, may experience discrimination. So there's a whole gamut of reactions that they have, coping mechanisms around hiding and being very strategic and camouflaging, and then a whole range of fears that they have about what consequences might be if people know about their sexual orientation.
You mentioned in the report that there was this very prevalent theme of don't ask and don't tell. What did you mean by that, and what is the outcome of that for elders?
Well, there are very concrete applications. I mean, people listening might think, well, why is it important for caregivers to know that someone is gay or lesbian when they're a senior citizen? But I'd ask those who are in heterosexual relationships to think what it might be to ask for services in a healthcare or social service setting and never be able to tell who your spouse is or what their relationship is to you or that they exist in your life. And what that means is that often people end up having to render their lives and a good part of their lives invisible. We had some really concrete examples of that, for example, where a same-sex partner would go to visit his partner who is in a nursing home and needing quite intensive care, and would show no sign of affection, would only visit during friends' visiting hours because they never claimed family status, because it was something that they feared claiming in terms of possible recriminations after. And so this, both the patient was deprived of the kind of support and affection that he had had his entire life from his partner. I think they had been together for 40 years. And the partner was not recognized as being a significant player and ally in the care that was being offered to his hospitalized spouse. Those are just, that's a very, you know, typical reaction that people had. They didn't name their relationships, their relationships weren't recognized, and people didn't give the kind of cues in terms of assessments and evaluations when people were being admitted for services that would allow someone to say, well, I'm in a same-sex relationship, and so I'd like my partner to be given the same status as a married heterosexual partner is with your heterosexual patients. That kind of thing was very, very prevalent. Before that, and before even getting into services, people would say they don't go to the doctor, they don't go for health care, they don't ask for home care until way late in their process and at a point where their needs are way beyond what they should be when someone would first generally enter the system. So we saw people that weren't getting diagnosed early on in terms of illness because they were afraid of discrimination, so they didn't go for help. They weren't getting home care when they needed it because they were afraid that home care workers might react negatively to them being gay or lesbian, so they were living in situations that most of us would consider to be unacceptable, only because they were afraid of possible recriminations.
How did the healthcare providers you talked to respond to questions about the sexual identity of their patients?
Well, there were several responses. I have to say that we did initial focus groups, and so we just got into contact with agencies fairly randomly across the country and asked them to talk to us about how they would react to gay and lesbian patients or same-sex couples. And on one level, there was a kind of stunned silence, saying, well, we've actually never even ever once thought of this issue. Or as an association, for example, that represents senior citizens, we've never once really ever thought that there might be seniors who are gay or lesbian. So that was one level of response. Another level of response was, well, it doesn't make any difference to know this, so why would this be important? And I think my comments from a little earlier give you one example of why this might be important, because we're talking about people's support systems and giving them the place in a patient's life that they need to have and that the patient needs them to have. And if we don't recognize those support systems, then they can't take their place. And the third level of reaction was one we found in a substantial minority of caregivers, and that was, boy, do we ever need to change some things on this issue. And yes, I've come into contact with elders who I suspect to be gay or lesbian who have indicated to me that they might be, and I just sense this incredible fear that they have with regards to me until I make it clear that I'm not going to have a discriminatory attitude, but especially with regards to services and care, that they worry enormously about the impact of potential discrimination. And again, just to put this in a kind of context, we would have people call us on the phone at McGill and say something like, are you the researchers doing the study on people like that? And we would say, yes, we're doing the study on people like that. Are you like that yourself? Yes, I am like that. And have you been in a relationship in a relationship with somebody else who's like that? Yes, I've been in a relationship for 35 years with someone who's like that too. Because even accessing the term gay or lesbian for many people, again, who live their lives, the great majority, under criminalization, who lived even longer under a diagnosis of mental illness, who never ever had their relationships recognized until 3 or 4 years ago legally, even access to the vocabulary can be difficult because you couldn't allow yourself to identify yourself like that socially for a very long time. And so many elders still don't. They'll talk about their best friend, they'll talk about their roommate, they'll talk about their very dear friend. But even the vocabulary, we have to be sensitive to what that might mean for someone who uses that kind of vocabulary and not wait for them to formally say, I am in a same-sex relationship. We don't really need that information if we ask people, who are the persons in your life who are the most important to you and that you want us to recognize? Then they just name them.
What did you, when as you were talking to people across the country, did you notice differences in the three areas that you studied, Vancouver, Montreal, and Halifax?
Yes. Probably, I would say that in terms of services, Vancouver was the most developed. You've had some wonderful work going on through the center in Vancouver over the last number of years. There have been some public health advisory committees looking at aging within the gay and lesbian community. There's been some community-based groups organized and affiliated with public services to reach out to this population. So already in Vancouver, we felt and heard a discourse that was more advanced. Halifax was the place that people were the most afraid. It's a smaller city, first of all. There may be less education being done on this issue. There's certainly been less organizing done on it. In Montreal, was probably the halfway point between the two. A lot of people said Montreal is a very progressive liberal city. It has been for years and years. And so social attitudes here might be easier. And a lot of the elders actually said they had moved from other places to Montreal. But in terms of services, Montreal is way behind in terms of developing policies, services, way behind Vancouver, for example. And we didn't touch Toronto. And people may be wondering, well, why wouldn't you go to the largest city? Because Toronto has done a lot of work on this issue over the last 10 years and has even begun developing specific adapted services. And so we felt that it would be more important to go to places where we could get information around what people were experiencing before these processes were put in place in a city like Toronto.
You make a number of recommendations in the study, and one of them is for more training of service providers.
Yes.
Is that training available?
With a great deal of difficulty in very few places. I'm associated with another research project right now where we're looking at professional schools in Canada, so universities that train healthcare professionals, for example, and doing a survey of how often even the issue of sexual orientation is broached without even talking about aging. And you can still graduate in 2006 in most schools of medicine, psychology, social work, education, gerontology, I don't know if I named nursing, without ever having heard a word on sexual orientation, period. And even more so when it has to do with aging or gerontology. We tend to not recognize sexuality in older people at all, even in terms of heterosexual sexuality. So recognizing same-sex sexuality is a bigger step for some people to make, and we have to start evolving on this issue, I think, for everyone. There's a whole generation of baby boomers that aren't going to accept the closed-mindedness of healthcare services for elders, including those who are gay and lesbian.
You also talk about creating a families of choice policy. What do you mean by that?
Well, because this is a population, particularly those who are over 60 and 65 today, that often lost the support and therefore their relationships with their biological families in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, these men and women often developed extremely strong support networks to replace their biological family relationships. So when they didn't have the support of mom, dad, or brothers and sisters, they often replaced that emotional need with the support of very, very close friends. And those friends aren't often recognized within the healthcare system as being important players that may actually supplant family in a person's life. Now, that can happen for heterosexual people as well, for all kinds of circumstances. But it's a theme that's common in the lives of gay and lesbian people, that their closest friends become the people with whom they have the strongest attachments often. And that's more, and that's truer the older a person is. And so with this population in the year 2006, those who are over 60, there may be a need to recognize their best friends as having the status of family, rather than saying, okay, are you biological family, so you get to visit during the intensive care visiting hours? And that biological family may have actually rejected the person who's hospitalized their entire life and not be an important person emotionally in their lives. And the people who are the friends with whom they've had decades-long friendships may not get in to visit because they're not recognized as biological family and therefore not important in the person's life. So the vocabulary family of choice is one that I think could accommodate the needs of many heterosexual men and women, but it specifically could accommodate the needs of gay and lesbian people who may not have had their families very present in their lives.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us this morning, Bill.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with Bill Ryan. He is one of the principal investigators in a recent study on the health and social service needs of gay and lesbian elders and their families. You can find a link to the study on our website, which is coopradio.org/redeye.